I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story.
Rio Tinto blew up ancient Aboriginal rock shelters at Juggan Gorge in May to get access to high-grade iron ore. The sites were among the oldest in...
When Rio Tinto destroyed a 46,000-year-old cave at Juggan Gorge in Western Australia, it caused global outrage.
The site has been described by archaeologists as home to the dawning of humanity.
Initially, Rio executives said there'd been a misunderstanding, that they believed the local Putu, Kunti, Kumara and Pinokura people were supportive of the plan. But a parliamentary inquiry later found that Rio was aware the PKKP didn't want the site to be demolished. These revelations have had huge repercussions as powerful investors demand accountability and change in how mining companies deal with Indigenous heritage. Today, could the destruction of Juggan Gorge change heritage laws for good? It's Thursday, the 24th of September. So last time we spoke about Juggan Gorge on Full Story, we asked if mining companies would be held accountable. Do we have an answer to that now, Lorena?
Well, we do. And the short answer is yes. In this instance, we did get some accountability.
Lorena Allam is The Guardian's Indigenous Affairs editor.
Pressure had been building for months since Rio Tinto destroyed the site in May. And shareholders had been calling for something to happen to the three top executives who were ultimately responsible for the explosion.
As a result of the findings, Rio's chief executive, Jean-Sébastien Jacques, will lose almost $5 million Australian dollars in bonuses and benefits. The head of iron ore, Chris Salisbury, and the group executive corporate relations, Simone Niven, will also lose their million-dollar bonuses.
At the end of August, it was announced that the three were having their bonuses docked, which really still wasn't enough to satisfy the shareholders and the institutional investors. And so at the end of August...
Beginning with the chief executive of global mining company Rio Tinto, stepping down after the company destroyed a sacred Aboriginal site in Australia.
It was announced that all three of them would be departing the company at the end of the year.
Yes, so Jean-Sébastien Jacques, the CEO of Rio Tinto, along with two other senior executives, is leaving the company by mutual agreement with the board. Rio Tinto blew up the Juggan Gorge rock shelters in May this year in order to expand an iron ore mine. The
caves were... Was that a surprise that these executives left the company?
There was, as the Aboriginal Affairs Minister Ben White said, there was a certain inevitability about it by the end of the affair. I mean, as more information emerged, it became just untenable for Rio Tinto to continue as it was.
I think it was a surprise. It's certainly an unprecedented move.
Calla Walquist is a reporter for Guardian Australia.
But I think the bigger surprise for Rio Tinto was that this caused as much outcry as it did.
But the chairman of Rio Tinto, Simon Thompson, has said in a statement, what happened at Juggan was wrong and we are determined to ensure that the destruction of a heritage site of such exceptional archaeological and cultural significance never occurs again at a Rio Tinto operation.
Rio Tinto wasn't taking a risk in its eyes and in the eyes of anyone in the mining industry by any of its actions up until the destruction of the gorge. Rio Tinto was surprised and the rest of the mining industry was surprised by the strength of the reaction. This is business as usual.
We are determined to learn from the lessons from Juggan and to re-establish our reputation as a leader in communities and heritage management.
So Rio Tinto, what was different this time, Lorena?
I think everyone's pondering that question. I mean, as Calla's just said, this is really standard practice across the Pilbara. They're all the mining companies are doing this. Because there's an intersection of the law and a powerful mining industry, there is a power imbalance operating, and the law doesn't necessarily provide any real protection to Aboriginal people who want to protect their sacred sites and their heritage. So, you know, Rio and all the other mining companies are operating perfectly legally in the Pilbara. it doesn't matter that Juukan Gorge was an important site just for the Puutu Kunti Kurrama and Pinikura people, or the PKKP, but for all of human history. It doesn't matter that this was one of the most studied sites in the world, or that it showed an unbroken connection to the PKKP for more than 46,000 years. I mean, the law offers no protection to traditional owners to stop this kind of thing happening. But this time, the difference was that the PKKP just weren't going to be silent and let it happen.
The most important of all the confluence of factors that led to Juukan Gorge becoming a global story is the bravery of the PKKP. And when we speak to other traditional owner groups in the Pilbara on surrounding lands, that is what they say to us. And often they say that to us off the record because they're bound by the same gag clauses that the PKKP were bound by. The PKKP took a really big legal risk in releasing the first media statement they did, in speaking up, in saying we are really hurt and we did not consent to this, because there is a multi-million dollar agreement in place that says they can't do that. They risked their agreement, which is the financial survival of that group of people, in order to say we didn't consent to this heritage.
So what you're telling me, Kala, is the only reason this story became a global story was because the PKKP spoke out against a mutual obligation they had with Rio Tinto to actually tell the world what had happened.
They issued a press release, and it sounds like such a small act, but it's a huge act of defiance. They issued a press release that resulted in massive changes and will greatly improve, I think, the way that heritage is treated around the Pilbara for decades to come, because they took the risk to stand up for their heritage.
It takes a lot for mob to speak up like that, but I think that says a lot about the immense cultural and spiritual harm that they would and are now suffering after the explosion. That they were so concerned that they wanted to risk everything to let people know that they weren't just gonna, that they didn't want this to happen to their country. We want our future generations to know that these are our sites and that that's their sites, and they want to leave something for those future generations to be proud of. And so they want to do everything they can to protect them.
We talked about this last time, but can you remind us what laws are operating in Western Australia that allow this to happen?
Yeah, so there's two main forms of legislation that traditional owners have to deal with. One is the Native Title Act, under which the traditional owners have to negotiate a land use agreement with people like mining companies and other resource companies who want to use their land. And they have to negotiate something within 6 months, or they stand to have no rights at all. And then the other legislation is the West Australian Aboriginal Heritage Act, under which they have no right to object to mining and no right of appeal over any decisions that the minister makes. So those two facts, combined with the fact that these land use agreements that traditional owners are forced into under native title often contain gag clauses, so-called gag clauses, that prevent them from speaking out even if new information comes to light about the significance of a site. And on top of all this, on top of an already stacked deck against Aboriginal people, there's a layer of Commonwealth legislation, which is equally difficult to access. The Federal Environment Minister does have the power to intervene to stop these sorts of things happening. But once again, the process and the time frame involved make it really hard for the traditional owners to navigate.
Under Western Australia's current Aboriginal heritage laws, you can apply to destroy, damage or impact Aboriginal heritage under what's called a Section 18 application. It's Section 18 of the legislation. The person who wants to destroy the heritage makes the application. Traditional owners have no legislated right of appeal or reply. And what we know from our research on this story is that in the past 10 years, the West Australian government has never refused a mining company's application to destroy heritage.
Now, Rochelle, this isn't the first time that priceless Aboriginal heritage sites have been destroyed.
That's right. Advocates for Aboriginal heritage protection say so much has been lost over the years, either legally or illegally. And all of these losses sadly highlight the power imbalance between the mining industry and the country's traditional owners. In this particular case with Rio Tinto, the cultural significance of the Juukan Gorge caves shouldn't be underestimated. The site...
Okay, so we've had these laws that have allowed mining companies to act the way they do. But the other thing that's happened is we've found out more about the way Rio Tinto acted during all this. Carla, can you talk me through that?
Yeah, so Rio Tinto did an internal review looking into how the destruction of Juukan Gorge occurred. And it was written by Michael Lestrange, who is a director of Rio Tinto, and was released last month. It made a couple of pretty general findings. But one of the things it said was that Rio Tinto failed its own internal standards when it came to protecting cultural heritage and failed what it said were its aspirations when it comes to working with Indigenous peoples and Indigenous groups. The report has been accused of being a bit of a whitewash and even been slightly misleading when it comes to what actually led up to the destruction of Juukan Gorge. The report uses a lot of corporate speak to describe the events in the lead up to the destruction and does so in a way that kind of avoids pinning personal responsibility on anyone.
What kind of corporate speak are we talking about, Carla?
Well, the phrase that that received the most attention was linked up decision making. It said there was a failure of linked up decision making between those who were in charge of the heritage section and knew the significance of Juukan Gorge and those who were designing the mine, and then senior executives as well. And that was the reason that there wasn't correct information flow through the company, meaning that people who had the power to stop the destruction of Juukan Gorge didn't necessarily know how significant it was. It also said there were failures of their heritage management information system. It talked about information being siloed into different departments of the company. This is all pretty standard corporate jargon.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but what they're trying to say by this very impenetrable corporate speak is that they didn't know about the significance of the site. Is that right?
Yes, that is the claim that they're making, that they did not, that the right people didn't know. Not that no one knew, the heritage team knew. Rio Tinto received a copy, a number of different reports about the significance of the site, reports that they actually paid for, but that those reports went to the heritage team. They were not escalated up to the appropriate level of executive in the company. And essentially, it appears that the structure of Rio Tinto prior to this incident was such that these heritage risks were dealt with at a much lower level. They were flagged. A Section 18 approval was sought and granted, and then it was no longer an issue. It wasn't something that executives needed to know about. And one of the changes proposed in the report is that all these heritage risks, which are corporate risks, which are shareholder risks, will now be escalated up to an executive committee so that they can't claim next time that they didn't know.
So Rio's internal report says the top executives didn't know about the significance of the site. How convincing is that, Lorena?
Not really, is the short answer.
We're well into an inquiry at the moment, looking at relationships between traditional owners and PBCs. This is post-native title determination, and also how they're able to get or what's impediments there in relation to getting economic benefits for the traditional owners.
A Senate inquiry was set up to find out what exactly happened. What was the sequence of events that led up to the explosion?
There have been concerns expressed by the minister in Western Australia about the use of the Section 18 power that's within their Heritage Act. And, of course, the companies themselves have been concerned about wanting to do the right thing. So it's an opportunity that I think for us to delve into how to get the balances right, because that seems to be what's not in sync at the moment, and understand the best practices that companies have adopted in the past and why, you know, something went wrong on this occasion.
And a number of contradictory statements emerged from that inquiry in evidence and in submissions. For example, we discovered that a meeting that Rio Tinto's senior executives held in May, the minutes of which were supplied to the Senate inquiry, The significance of the gorge was mentioned in the sense that they were made aware that the PKKP had concerns about it. And the senior executives in that meeting were more worried about the potential damage to another site nearby, a site they didn't already have permission to damage, than they were worried about Juukan Gorge. In fact, they discussed lawyering up, so to speak. So they'd gotten legal advice to prepare for any blowback about the explosion of Juukan Gorge from the traditional owners. So not only did that contradict their previous statement that they didn't know, here was evidence that they were getting legal advice to prepare for a fight over it and that they clearly intended to go ahead. So it was pretty damning evidence. And certainly Warren Entsch, the chair of that inquiry, later told us that he said it was very difficult to see how Rio hadn't misled the Senate inquiry.
But we're not there to, hang people to the wall. We basically want to understand these very serious matters about protecting First Nations heritage and obviously ensuring that development can take place that contributes to the profitability of the nation.
So Rio initially claimed that they had the permission of the PKKP to destroy this site. Did that turn out to be true?
I don't know the answer to this question. The PKKP say that they, particularly once they learned the significance of the site after the archaeological dig in 2014 that was paid for by Rio Tinto, they say that they made the significance of the site to them known to Rio Tinto. But the initial permissions, the initial agreements around Juukan Gorge were negotiated back in 2006 before the PKKP had native title, before an archaeological dig on the site had been done, before the age of the site was known. In those initial 2006 negotiations, which were repeated in like 2011 and then finalised in 2015, the PKKP had the option to nominate areas as being wholly protected from mining, and Juukan Gorge wasn't nominated. So it is open to Rio Tinto to say we had negotiations over more than 10 years over this, and those negotiations resulted in an agreement that I think was some 170 pages, and none of those 170 pages name a protection for Juukan Gorge, but they do bind the PKKP against speaking out publicly against Rio Tinto or against publicly objecting to any applications to destroy heritage other than any protections that were negotiated in the agreement. So technically there was agreement.
But were there any other options available to Rio Tinto that avoided destruction of Juukan Gorge?
Yeah, there were. This was actually one of the most damning pieces of information that came out of the Senate inquiry into the destruction of Juukan Gorge. And it came from Rio Tinto's own submission. Rio said that when they were designing Brockman 4, which is the iron ore mine that Juukan Gorge has the misfortune of sitting on, they had four options for that mine pit design. Three of those options would have left Juukan Gorge alone, provided a buffer of varying distances. The fourth option would have allowed Rio Tinto to access some $135 million worth of additional high-grade iron ore, and that option involved destroying Juukan Gorge, and that is the option that Rio Tinto took. And J.S. Jacques, when asked about this in the Senate inquiry, was pretty blunt. He just said, yes, we went with the option that was worth more money. No, we didn't tell the PKKP that we were considering different options. And from their perspective, they did not need to because they already had legal permission to destroy it. So why would they go back on that legal permission to tell them that they had other options?
Next, will new heritage laws make a difference in Western Australia? So obviously something needs to change with the laws that govern heritage in Western Australia. What could happen and what needs to change?
A few things have happened since this site was destroyed.
Rochelle, what has been the reaction in Australia, particularly from Indigenous communities?
Well, the National Native Title Council welcomed the news that Rio Tinto's top three executives were getting the boot, but said this was only the first step. Its chief executive, Jamie Lowe, said the laws need to be strengthened. And that's what the government is working towards at the moment. A review of the Aboriginal Heritage Act 1972 is currently underway.
The first is that the West Australian government has finally released the draft of its new Aboriginal heritage laws, which replace the 48-year-old laws.
And now the Act currently excludes Aboriginal voices, but the revised version will give Aboriginal groups a seat at the table.
The new draft laws are better than the old laws in that they include a right of reply from traditional owners. They importantly state that the heritage belongs to traditional owners. The previous Act said that the heritage belonged to the state government. And they are based on principles of agreement making and negotiation around the destruction of heritage. But as Lorena said when she was talking about the issues around agreements under native title, the problem with an agreement making process is that it tends to favour the person with the more expensive lawyers, which is always the mining company.
State leaders say there'll be greater cooperation between mining companies and the country's traditional owners, and more inclusive measures that would provide better protection for these sacred sites in the future.
And you say right of reply. That's not an objection or right to appeal, is it?
There is a limited right to appeal.
Right. So that's an improvement.
It is an improvement. There was that right to appeal is on both sides. Both the person who wants to destroy the heritage and the person whose heritage it is has the right to appeal, has the right to take the matter to mediation if they can't make a non-mediated agreement around the heritage. So it does restore some of the balance back towards traditional owners, but it could definitely be argued that it doesn't go far enough and that it still relies on, to a large extent, the goodwill of both governments and mining companies to do the right thing.
Lorena, something else we mentioned in the last podcast episode where we talked about this was the influence of investors, particularly superannuation funds, in relation to the protection of sacred sites. Are they satisfied with what's happened so far?
They have achieved a lot, but they are demanding more. HESTA, which is a $52 billion superannuation fund, and Australian Super, which is the biggest super fund in Australia, have both said they want further changes to the way Rio Tinto does business in the Pilbara, the way it deals with traditional owners, and they want some real changes to their processes made public and transparent so investors can have confidence again that their investments don't carry the social risk that they clearly have now. So HESTA's even said it intends to go to other global investors in Rio Tinto and lobby them to get involved in pushing Rio and the other mining companies for greater transparency around these agreements that they make with traditional owners. So there are some serious questions being asked about what these agreements entail, what rights traditional owners have been asked to give up or coerced into giving up to reach agreement with mining companies. And as the Bundjuma traditional owners said to the Senate inquiry, we are stuck with this situation now where we either take the deal or we take nothing. And so while they want to exercise their self-determination to make deals that might benefit them economically, they also need the protection of legislation at a state and federal level to enable them to make free, prior and informed consent.
Rio Tinto was actually asked to publicly release its agreement with the PKKP by the Senate inquiry. It didn't. It released some sections. The rest was released in confidence to the inquiry because it is obviously a commercial in confidence document. And it should be noted that traditional owner groups don't necessarily want the full text of these agreements released because, as I said, they are worth millions and millions of dollars. And that's private financial information for native title holders that they don't necessarily want advertised. But there are some sort of standard clauses in these agreements. I think it would be difficult for the mining companies to argue against the release of those standard clauses, which included things like what's called a non-disparagement clause, which basically just means that you won't trash talk the mining company publicly. I think there'll be a lot of pressure to declare when those kind of clauses are in place.
And so how has the mining industry reacted to these calls? As you said, it's not just Rio Tinto, it's other mining companies as well.
Yes, so we can talk about the other two big companies in the Pilbara because we've been talking to them and writing about them. BHP has set up an advisory board made up of traditional owners and BHP senior executives to kind of talk through all the issues that have been raised with their agreement with the Bunjuma people that we reported on in June. BHP has permission to blow up at least 40 and up to 86 sites sacred to the Bunjuma people. That permission was granted by the minister in the days after Rio Tinto exploded Juukan Gorge, so which was a fairly shocking discovery. Bunjuma people like the PKKP took a real risk in speaking out about their concerns. When that came out, BHP's now made amends or trying very hard to make amends and to show that they are a good corporate citizen, or certainly better than Rio. In the last week or so, they've also announced, they gave evidence to the Senate inquiry last week and said that they are now able to, in negotiation with the Bunjuma, save 10 of those 40 sites, and negotiations are ongoing. So, I mean, the question is now whether BHP can go from saying that saving none of those sites was practicable to saying now 10 of them can be saved. So the question is now, why can't you save all of them?
And what about the second company? You mentioned you've been talking to two companies in the Pilbara.
So Fortescue Mining, when we sought comment from their CEO, Elizabeth Gaines, she said the agreements that they have with traditional owners don't contain gag clauses, and they've said they're very proud of the work they do with traditional owners in the Pilbara. They say they take a lot of time and care in their dealings, but again, like all the mining companies, they're not really keen on making their agreements transparent. Unlike BHP, which has allowed its shareholders to vote on a resolution about its behaviour in the Pilbara, Fortescue Mining has kind of rejected a push by shareholder activists to have their conduct questioned at the upcoming AGM. So the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility has sought a resolution for Fortescue to make its agreements transparent and to put a moratorium on any mining in the Pilbara that might damage or destroy significant Aboriginal sites. And while BHP has said, yes, we will allow our shareholders to vote on this at the next AGM in October, Fortescue has said they won't let their shareholders vote on it this year because the notification didn't arrive by the cutoff date. Mm. So there's a bit of a difference in the way the mining companies are operating up there. And of course, we're still waiting for what the Senate inquiry will say about the broader issues facing the industry and how resolved they are to even up the playing field.
So this story began with the PKKP. How are they feeling now?
The Senate inquiry was set to travel to the Pilbara and sit down with them and other traditional owners. And of course, you know, the changes to West Australia's border laws have made that difficult for now. So they were quite disappointed. They were really looking forward to having their opportunity to speak in person and to show the Senate inquiry the extent of the destruction at Juukan Gorge. And that's the most respectful way to do it. And I think, you know, if anyone in this gigantic disaster deserves to have their voices heard in the way that they want, it's the PKKP. So while they can't meet with the Senate face-to-face right now, Warren Inch has said it's extremely important that they go there and sit down and hear from them. Because, I mean, the fact that they have been heard so little in this cacophony of condemnation of Rio and the behaviour of other mining companies, here's this traditional owner group right at the heart of the story who are kind of silenced by the whole thing, which speaks volumes about the situation that we are in here.
And part of that has been a conscious decision of the PKKP. They made the initial statement and they have continued to make statements at moments that they feel required their response. on the whole, they are attempting to negotiate with Rio Tinto still. They've successfully negotiated a moratorium around Juukan Gorge. It will not be mined. It will never be mined. That extra 135 million of iron ore, and in fact, considerable amount more of iron ore, will not be touched anymore as a result of this incident. So they are negotiating with Rio Tinto. They are keeping those negotiations private because they remain in an ongoing partnership with Rio Tinto. They have other sites that they want to protect. They have elders that they want to protect and that they want to make sure are comfortable with the situation. This is not a grandstanding group of people. And they have, on a number of occasions, said that they will say the bulk of what they have to say in their submission to the Senate inquiry, which has not yet been published. And they will say the rest in person to the Senate inquiry when the Senate inquiry is able to speak to them on country.
I would just add to that by saying that the Bunjima and the Gorima people and the other traditional owners of the Pilbara have all said similar things. They don't want to stop negotiating with mining companies, and they make it very clear they're not opposed to mining. They just want to protect the sites that are important and sacred to them, and that's their end goal.
Hmm. Yeah, as Lorraine said, this isn't a story of traditional owners versus the mining industry. It's not an either or. Traditional owners in the Pilbara are very often part of the mining industry. Birchall Hayes, the spokesman for the PKKP, he works in mining. Most people in the Pilbara who live on country work in mining because it's the only industry in town. It's a question of respectful relationships and whether or not mining companies treat traditional owners on whose land they operate with respect, with dignity, and actually observe their wishes.
That's it for today. You can find more reporting from Lorena and Calla at theguardian.com. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe. It's available in all good podcast apps. This episode was produced by Ellen Leibeater, Joe Koning and Miles Herbert. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me. I'll see you back here tomorrow.